Somewhat problematic is not what I'm hearing from our veterans. They're saying it is fouled up, it is screwed up, it is a mess.
Senator Murkowski highlights continued dysfunction at the VA in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking for snow in south-central Alaska this winter? Head up, way up.
Generally, the further up the mountain we go, the closer to normal the snowpack becomes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Senator Lisa Murkowski told a top VA official this morning that she's still hearing disaster stories about the CHOICE program. And she says some Alaska vets who use CHOICE to get medical appointments in the private sector now find collection agencies are after them because the VA hasn't paid their claims. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
VA Undersecretary David Shulkin says his agency is doing a better job in Alaska now, at least compared to last summer when he visited the state and got an earful.
Currently, 96% of all appointments are scheduled within 30 days in Alaska.
Shulkin, at a Senate hearing, said in 120 cases, veterans seeking urgent consultations through the CHOICE program have been kept waiting longer than 30 days.
They're all scheduled, but that's too long, and that's what we're working with TriWest to fix.
Alaska vets say the CHOICE program is the trouble. Before it launched across the country last year, if they needed to see a specialist outside the VA would make an appointment for them, nice and simple. Now, vets have to deal with TriWest, the contract administrator for CHOICE, and many say they can't get through to get the appointments they need. But Shulkin says they've made adjustments to serve Alaska. The undersecretary also says they're trying to reduce the role of TriWest so that the VA does the scheduling. But he acknowledged CHOICE is still somewhat problematic. Murkowski pounced, saying Shulkin is underplaying the frustrations.
And your term, somewhat problematic is not what I'm hearing from our veterans. They're saying it is fouled up, it is screwed up, it is a mess. And it's unacceptable. It's unacceptable because we know how to correct it, because we corrected it. And then you come in and you create chaos.
Murkowski says in some respects, the situation is worse.
And now what we're getting, the letters that I'm getting from vets are saying, my bills are being sent to collection agencies when the VA doesn't pay.
According to a story in Military Times, vets around the country are seeing their credit ruined because they got medical service through CHOICE and the VA isn't paying the bills on time. The publication says the VA is substantially worse at paying claims within a month when compared to other government insurance programs like TRICARE and Medicare. Murkowski says another problem with CHOICE is that Alaska's medical specialists don't like it. Alaska doesn't have enough medical specialists to start with, Murkowski says, and fewer than ever are willing to see veterans.
Specialists who were willing to take the CHOICE card are now telling me they don't want to have anything to do with the hassle. Nothing at all.
Shulkin acknowledged that Alaska had a model system before, and he said they're trying to get back to it. But the undersecretary said it wasn't the VA that opted for the new system.
This was the CHOICE program. This was Congress's program that we are trying to make work.
He called it unacceptable that vets are being hounded by bill collectors for unpaid medical services. He says the VA has established a special hotline vets can call to get intervention. But call early in the day. Here's how the hotline sounds when you call on an Alaska afternoon.
Thank you for calling the Department of Veterans Affairs. We are currently closed. Our normal hours of operation are Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. through 3 p.m. Mountain Time.
Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
As legislators make cuts to the state's budget, they're looking to draw money from various state funds to cover costs. But drawing money from the fund that helps rural Alaskans pay utility bills and cutting money to local governments are raising concerns, APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The House Finance Committee is considering a budget bill that would cut state government spending $400 million more than the $100 million in cuts Governor Bill Walker proposed. House Bill 256 would change the source of funding for two budget items. A roughly $77 million payment to the teachers' retirement system would be paid from a fund that pays for college scholarships and grants. And roughly $25 million for the University of Alaska would come from the Power Cost Equalization Fund, rather than the operating budget. Big Lake Republican Representative Mark Newman says the proposal draws on available funds to meet the committee's priority, balancing the state's budget. Newman is the committee's co-chairman.
We're still in the first innings here. Well, you know, we're trying to make sure we're setting up the budget for the final decisions that we have to do.
The teachers' retirement system would receive money from the Higher Education Investment Fund, which was started 4 years ago with $400 million. It was launched to fund Alaska education grants, which are for post-secondary students with unmet financial needs, and Alaska performance scholarships for students with high grades. If the state draws out similar amounts to the proposed $77 million, the fund would be exhausted in a few years. Newman says he expects all current grant and scholarship recipients to continue to receive the money. The $25 million for the university is a small share of the overall $900 million Power Cost Equalization Fund. But the proposal concerns New Haven resident Evelyn Trevon. She's a board member for a small regional electric co-op whose customers benefit roughly $90 per month from cost equalization.
Power Cost Equalization was set aside as a fund to help rural Alaskans, and it wasn't designed to help the University of Alaska. They needed look at the budget situation and figure out their own source of revenue funding, and power cost equalization is essential for rural Alaskans.
Newman says drawing money for the university this year shouldn't have any effect on PCE payments.
This was excess funds. It's funds that weren't needed to make the mandatory statutory payment for power cost equalization. It has no effect on paying PCE or any future payments.
The House Finance Committee also cut a $35 million payment that Walker planned for community revenue sharing. If this change is kept, it would be the second straight year that the state didn't add any money to the revenue sharing program. Without more money, the program fund would be so low, there could be no revenue sharing in 2 years. Alaska Municipal League Executive Director Kathy Wasserman is concerned about the issue. She noted that rural areas depend on the money to provide basic services.
The large communities, it will impact them. The small communities, it could devastate. And then when you look at the other cost shifting that is going on due to the budget crunch that we have, I'm not sure how some municipalities are going to make it through.
Newman says he's aware of the concern and says the committee would like to make changes that would make revenue sharing more secure.
Everything's on the table right now. I'm certainly cognizant of the needs of a lot of the communities within the state of Alaska, particularly small rural villages across Alaska and their ability to do their governmental functions. And yes, we're certainly taking those under consideration.
The committee also cut $25 million from the public employee retirement system. That money could be restored in the next week based on the details of a state actuarial analysis of the pension fund. And it proposed a cut of roughly $25 million for the AK LNG project. Committee members want more details about how the money would be spent before budgeting it. Walker asked for the money to prepare the pipeline's front-end engineering and design work. This week, the committee has been hearing public testimony on the budget from residents statewide ahead of a vote on the budget. It would then head to a vote by the full House before being considered by the Senate. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
A bill that would impose penalties on affiliates of abortion service providers for providing teaching materials to Alaska public schools has been deemed constitutionally problematic by the legislature's Legal Services Division. Senate Bill 191 was introduced last month by Senator Mike Dunleavy to accompany his proposal to ban groups like Planned Parenthood from providing sex education curriculum in schools. Senate Minority Leader Berta Gardner requested the legal review to look at whether SB 191 violates the Constitution. The legal counsel's report says the bill could infringe on First Amendment freedom of speech, for example, by preventing public school teachers from volunteering with Planned Parenthood in their free time. It also concluded that the bill compromises equal protection laws by singling out employees and representatives of abortion service providers for differential treatment. The Senate Education Committee was scheduled to take up Senate Bill 191 this afternoon. It's been more than 2 weeks since Representative Max Gruenberg died, and his legacy lives on in the Capitol. The House Judiciary Committee room was named after him. One area where his legacy is contested is what will happen to the legislative records he left behind. Kayla Epstein, his widow, wants control of his records, but she's been blocked. She hopes the documents will help the bills Gruenberg was working on become law.
I was pretty shocked. I was pretty shocked and to do that to someone who so recently, I mean, it was within days of Max's dying, and I knew that he would be absolutely opposed to this, and he would have been the first person to figure out how to stop it.
However, lawyer Doug Gardner wrote in a memo that Gruenberg's papers were protected by legislative immunity. Gardner directs the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency's Legal Services Office. Anchorage Republican Representative Craig Johnson cited Gardner's opinion in denying Epstein access to the records. The state followed the same rules when Palmer Republican Representative Carl Gatto died in 2012. But Epstein disagrees with that interpretation. She notes legislative immunity in Alaska is based on a similar provision in the U.S. Constitution.
In the federal government, when a legislator dies, their papers are sent to their heirs within 90 days. That is their rules. Our rules are based on the federal rules. There really is no reason that I have not gotten Max's papers.
Legislators are talking about changing the rules to indicate what they want to happen to their records if they die in office. Ohio State University law professor Stephen Huffner has studied the issue of legislative immunity. He says the precedent for how to handle records after a legislator dies in office isn't clear.
What I think is important is to give members, before they pass on, an opportunity to decide what their wishes are. Obviously, you've got a problem here because that didn't happen. So in this instance, it's tricky. But I think members ought to be able to decide ahead of time that they want their papers to become public.
Epstein says she plans to file a request for the records soon. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Nome National Forest takes shape on the sea ice.
Somebody put a Christmas tree out there, and another person, next thing you know, it became a tradition.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing, and 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information, and remember the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The oil and gas company Apache Corporation says it will suspend its Alaska operations. The company is one of the largest leaseholders in Cook Inlet, where it has been exploring for oil since 2010. In an emailed statement, a company spokesperson said Apache is slashing spending for the coming year by 60% as a result of low oil prices and halting work in several regions, including Alaska. The spokesperson said the company expects minimal job losses since it has been scaling back operations in the state for the last year. Apache is an independent oil and gas company based in Houston with operations across North America and in the UK and Egypt. Last week, the company reported a net loss of $23 billion in 2015. The village of Igiagig has been awarded nearly $400,000 from the U.S. Department of Energy to make improvements on a hydropower system that could replace the use of diesel fuel for the town of 70 on Lake Iliamna. KDLG's Hannah Colton has more.
The RivGen power system, developed by the Ocean Renewable Power Company, has been successfully tested in the Quijack River outside of the village of Igiagig for the past two summers. But there are logistical challenges, and the village plans to use this new grant money to continue tweaking the system to make it easier and cheaper to operate. One challenge is that the turbines must be taken out of the river each spring while the ice flows out. Igiagig Village Council President Alexana Salmon says that used to be a predictable two-week window, but now the warmer winters are disrupting that schedule.
Like right now, we're 40 degrees in the beginning of March, and this is often our coldest month, so there's no ice out in the lake. And last winter, we had two ice breakups, so we wanted to study more on ice to see how it interacts with the device, if it's possible to keep the device in, you know, if minimal ice is flowing down the river.
Another environmental factor the village is concerned with, says Salmon, is having the turbines in the water when the young salmon are going out.
The device was installed at the peak of the salmon, sockeye salmon return last summer, and over a million swam by it, and there was no harm to fish. So we know that the adult salmon are in the clear. So this would be focusing on out-migrating salmon smolt and ice formation and movement.
The third round of testing, along with the new smolt research, will begin this summer. The Department of Energy has approved the nearly $400,000 for the first phase of the project, and the village could be selected to receive up to $1.1 million more in funding. Eventually, the village aims to supply 100% of its energy needs using two of the RivGen units. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
It may seem like another crummy winter in South Central, but if you're willing to head up, not north, but upward in elevation, there's a different winter story playing out. APRN contributor Monica Goki has this story as part of our Where is Winter series.
It's a wet and windy day up Turnagain Pass. You can hear the high-pitched squeal of snow machines ricocheting around, but you can't see them. Visibility is low, and everything's socked in. Anchorage snowmachiners Mike Lindemann and Nolan Bodeheimer just got back from a rip. The rubber track on one of their snow machines is loose. Lindemann tightens the track with a wrench.
The rubber track stretches out, so they make these tensioners right here.
Lindemann says wet snow exacerbates this problem, and it's pretty wet out, but he isn't complaining too much.
It's actually pretty nice this year because Turnagain Pass is actually open. Last year it wasn't open, so our nearest place to ride was 2.5 hours, 3 hours away.
Turnagain Pass wasn't open to snow machiners last year because of a lack of snow. Backcountry skiers were there too, and they had to hoof it, skis strapped to their backs, for 20 to 30 minutes before there was enough snow to skin up the mountain. The Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center keeps tabs on snow activity in the Turnagain Pass area. Avalanche Center Director Wendy Wagner has been on the mountain all year, and she says yes, yes indeed, winter is back this year.
So our snowpack at right around tree line and above tree line and what we call the alpine is more than average. And that's wonderful because it lays down a lot of the alders and people are able to recreate in many areas that they haven't been able to recreate the last couple of years.
Now that the snow's in, backcountry users have been coming in droves.
We had a sunny weekend a couple weekends ago, and there's, I would say, almost 1,000 people out recreating on Turnagain Pass.
1,000 people at Turnagain Pass might sound insane, but Wagner says the area is big enough that it doesn't exactly feel like Alyeska, say, on a Saturday. And speaking of Alyeska, they too are having a good snow year, up top at least. Down low, not so much. Daniel Fisher of the National Resources Conservation Service manages the automated snow measuring sites across the state. And the numbers concur with what people are seeing on the ground.
Generally, the further up the mountain we go, the closer to normal the snowpack becomes.
Snowpack is even well above the norm at some of the higher elevation sites. At Hatcher Pass, for example, snowpack is at about 140%. Up Turnagain Pass, 160% of normal. But the lower elevation sites tell a different story. At a number of spots, like Portage Valley and Kincaid Park, there's less snow now than there was in December. Low-lying areas have been melted out by winter rain. So what's with the awful winter down low and the great winter up top?
Well, at one point, it would certainly seem unusual, but I mean, looking at the last 3 years, that's been sort of what's been going on.
Fisher says there are two reasons you get a low snowpack. The first, precipitation is below average. That is not the case this year.
But you can also have low snowpack because your precipitation is coming as rain instead of snow.
Got it. And that seems to be what's happening this year.
Exactly. Yeah, that's been sort of what's happened the last 3 years.
It's what Fisher calls a temperature-driven snowpack. The precipitation is right on schedule, but it's just falling as rain instead of snow in the low-lying areas. But up high, well, there's enough snow for Lindemann and Bodenheimer. They're getting ready to head high up the mountain.
So yesterday I was up to the ridgeline. Today we haven't quite gotten there yet.
They fire up their snow machines and tear off, pointing themselves at an invisible ridgeline. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Gokey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and artisan groceries, including Alaskan products, across Alaska. Learn about year-round delivery options at fullcircle.com/APRN. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A contingent of Alaskans is traveling to Greenland to participate in the Arctic Winter Games. Alaska's is one of nine regional teams descending on the northern nation's capital of Nuuk for next week's games. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the remote Arctic city is going all out to host them.
Nuuk, Greenland has 17,000 residents, and a lot of them are involved in putting on the 2016 Arctic Winter Games.
Four out of five people in Nuuk are involved in the games, either as a volunteer or as an employee.
Pipaluk Lind is an Arctic Winter Games logistics assistant in Nuuk, who's frank when asked about the challenge of hosting the games.
I think the shortest way to answer that question is saying overwhelming.
Lynn says Nuuk is drawing on experience from previously hosting the biennial games in 2002, adding that the influx of several thousand people to the remote Arctic city creates some obvious needs.
We've had to import a bunch of containers with toilets and showers for all the participants and like a bunch of other stuff of that kind.
Lynn says local schools will house athletes and other existing facilities will provide venues for 14 Arctic Winter Games sports. But hockey will be played a two-hour flight away on rinks in Iqaluit, Nunavut. She says, challenges aside, Nuuk is excited to host the games.
The Arctic Winter Games is on everyone's lips in Nuuk, and everyone is counting down. We have a volunteer center in the city center. And there's a countdown clock telling down to seconds how much time is left until the opening ceremony starts.
Getting to Nuuk in time for Sunday's opening ceremonies involves a lot of air travel for faraway teams like Alaska's. Team Alaska co-director Kathleen Ream says transporting Alaska's 300 participants to Nuuk is complicated by the city's small size.
The airport in Nuuk is unable to hold large passenger planes, so you have to take multi-leg journeys. It's going to be a huge adventure for these young athletes.
Arctic Winter Games typically attract participants' family and friends, but Ream says access to Greenland during the games is very limited, and it's been tough for spectators to book a trip.
Those that were successful, they found their airline tickets months ago, and it's been a popular event, so the tickets have sold out.
Ream adds that the journey is expensive, about $4,000 per person for Team Alaska, noting that a state grant reduces what athletes pay. The 2016 Arctic Winter Games run March 6th through the 11th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
If you gaze out from Nome's Front Street this time of year, you will see Norton Sound covered with ice that extends to the horizon. By this time next week, the community's old Christmas trees will dot the frozen ocean. As KNOM's Mitch Border reports, it's an effort to revive a tradition called the Nome National Forest.
Three men repair and paint a variety of large plywood cutouts. There's a duck, Mickey Mouse, and various other shapes scattered throughout a vacant garage that echoes with the sounds of a radio.
Now, art's in the eyes of the beholder, right?
Painting is not Mitch Erickson's normal weekend activity. Erickson is the ringleader of the group that is diligently preparing colorful decorations to disperse out on the sea ice along with the old Christmas trees. Volunteer Charlie Painter may not have found himself painting a large yellow duck if it hadn't been for a particular motivation.
Well, I think I'm hoping Mitch is going to look favorably on me and buy beer later.
Mitch Erickson and the rest of the crew are trying to revive the Nome National Forest, a tradition that has all but died out. Erickson says the forest began as a creative way for the community to discard old Christmas trees.
The history behind it is somebody put a Christmas tree out there, and another person, next thing you know, it became a tradition.
The purpose of the plywood cartoon characters is to give more life to the evergreens assembled on the sea ice. Erickson says reviving the forest was Mayor Richard Benville's idea.
The mayor drives around and says, "Hey, Mitch, I saw a tree at so-and-so location. Go get it." So I go get it. And no one shot at me yet.
Because I'm mayor. And I want it. How's that for a reason? That may sound egotistical, but the mayor's got some power.
Mayor Benville wants to reinvigorate the Nome National Forest, since it has been absent from Nome sea ice for at least 3 years. The disappearance of the forest was due to the passing of the original founder and a few of its organizers. Mayor Benville believes reestablishing this event and others like it will draw more tourists downtown for the festivities that take place during the Iditarod. As he puts the finishing touches on a plywood ghost, Charlie Painter is not thinking of tourism, but rather what the trees and cutouts bring to Nome's view.
It's a pretty cool thing. I gotta admit, you look out on the ocean and there's nothing to look at. And it's just a sea of white and it's beautiful in itself, but it's kind of cool to look at something, and these cutouts are pretty cool to look at.
Mayor Benville wants this so bad that he has even created a radio ad to ask residents for their discarded Christmas trees.
You might be wondering why I'm singing Christmas carols. This is Mayor Richard.
The mayor and the rest of the volunteers expect to set up the trees and cutouts in time for Iditarod spectators and dog teams that will arrive in less than 2 weeks.
Next year, I want to get back up to 100 trees. Yeah! Who else but a bunch of gnomies to put Christmas trees out and make a forest out of it? I think it's very cool.
In Nome, I'm Mitch Borden.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Rachel Waltholz and Monica Goki in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Mitch Border in Nome. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.